Israel launches fresh airstrikes on areas near the Syrian capital Damascus, killing two civilians. Syria says it has hit most of the missiles. Russia says it will open up humanitarian corridors from several Ukrainian cities on the 12th day of the conflict between the two countries. Iran's president says his administration is serious about sanctions removal talks, but does not tie any of its moves in foreign policy and economic fields to the Vienna talks. Hi, everybody. I'm Behrouz Najafi. Welcome. Israel has carried out air raids on targets near the Syrian capital Damascus, killing two civilians. A military source says the attacks also caused some material damage. Air defenses confronted the Israeli aggression and hit most of the missiles. And this after reports of explosions in the sky over Damascus. Israel regularly conducts missile strikes on Syrian territory. Last month, three Syrian soldiers were killed in a missile attack by the regime on the vicinity of Damascus. The Syrian government has time and again condemned the aggression, asking the United Nations to hold Tel Aviv to account. Now, right at this moment, Russia is set to open up humanitarian corridors from several Ukrainian cities, including the capital Kiev. This is the 12th day of the conflict between the two countries. Russian media says the corridors from Kharkiv, Sumy, and Mariupol will also be set up at the request of French President Emmanuel Macron. The development follows a phone call between Russian President Vladimir Putin and his French counterpart. During the conversation, Putin said that Moscow is planning to achieve its objective in Ukraine, either through diplomacy or military means. He also told the Turkish president earlier that Russia would end the attack once its demands are met and Ukraine stops fighting. Ukraine says that Russia is now preparing to shell the southern city of Odessa.
They are preparing to bomb Odessa. This is going to be a military crime. This is going to be a historical crime and a war crime.
Zelensky also slammed the West for rejecting his demand to impose a no-fly zone over Ukraine or arm it with fighter jets. However, despite a continued heavy fighting on the ground, both Russia and Ukraine are preparing for the third round of peace talks that are scheduled to be held today, March 7th. The exact time and location of the negotiations are not clear yet. The United Nations says that nearly 360 civilians have been killed since the beginning of the conflict on the 24th of February. A political commentator, Sarah Flounder, says the United States wants to use the Ukraine crisis as a pretext to impose more sanctions on Russia aimed at weakening the country. Let's take a listen.
The U.S. is using Ukraine as a way of battering Russia along its 1,200-mile border. The constant use for 8 years of U.S. heavy equipment, U.S. advisors, which are really U.S. troops, but they're, quote, advisors, mercenaries, fascist forces, and Contras. Now they want to escalate that. But they have been doing this for 8 years. And if they wanted this war to end today, it would end today if the U.S. stopped pumping in all of these millions, billions of dollars of lethal arms, U.S. advisors into the Ukraine. But really, they're doing all of this to make a war on Russia, to block the enormous amount of trade that had developed between Russia and the European Union, and the trade from China and Russia into the European Union. The European Union was the largest investor in Russia. The U.S. wants to break all of this, and they're determined to block it. They're determined to block it through the sanctions, and now they're determined to also block it through a war that will lay ruin to all of Ukraine.
Protests have been held in several countries against Russia's military offensive in Ukraine. In the United States, protesters rallied outside the White House, calling for an end to the ongoing conflict between Moscow and Kiev. In North America, elsewhere, hundreds of people turned out in the Canadian city of Toronto in support of Ukrainian people. Mexicans also marched through the capital of Mexico City, waving Ukrainian flags and denouncing Russia for its military actions against its Western neighbor. A similar protest took place in the Argentinian capital, Buenos Aires. Now, Russia's military offensive against the Ukraine has sent traders into a frenzy, with oil prices briefly soaring to the highest level since the 2008 financial crisis. The global oil benchmark Brent crude spiked above $139 a barrel before easing back to below $130. Energy markets have been rocked in recent days over supply fears, with the U.S. mulling an embargo on Russian oil. U.S. gasoline prices jumped 11% over the past week, the highest since 2008. Other commodities are also seeing a rise. Gold hit a peak of more than $2,000 an ounce in Asian trade, its highest level since September 2020. Stocks in Hong Kong, meantime, tumbled more than 3% in the first few minutes of trade on Monday amid concerns among investors. Okay, now let me invite Steve Keen, economist and author of the New Economics Manifesto. Okay, Steve, you just heard the story. So what's been going on in Ukraine that's been impacting global trade? How serious could this be and what the effect could be? Who's going to lose? Who's going to win?
It's something which it's obviously a huge impact on a whole range of fronts. It isn't just oil. It's also going to be wheat, because we're taking out two of the world's major wheat producers in one conflict, which is bizarre, but that's what's happening. And this is not just the Ukraine, it's also climate change. And the combination of this with COVID as well is bringing to an end a period of drastically reducing prices caused by globalization and exploitation of easily available and cheap energy. Now, globalization is being destroyed by COVID, and it'll get worse. And we're also having the same effect with the availability of cheap energy disappearing too, in that it's much more expensive to get the oil out of the ground in energy terms. So you put those combination together, we're likely to see a reversal of a long period of deflation and have an inflation caused by supply shortages.
Mm-hmm. And Steve, who's going to be the biggest loser? Is it the consumer or the country's governments?
Well, we both lose, ultimately. The real danger is we have to hold together a society which has only been preserved through rising inequality by nonetheless a rising living standard for the majority. If these price rises come through and are imposed just upon the poor and the middle class, societies will fall apart. So this has to be something which reverses the inequality that's been increased over the last 40 years. And my worry is that it's the last thing that the people running central banks are aware of, because things like quantitative easing are actually still increasing the inequality.
Okay, thanks for that. Steve Keen, economist and author of the New Economics Manifesto. Now, moving on, Iran's top security official says that securing the interests of the Iranian people is the only factor affecting Tehran's interaction with the P4+1 countries in the Vienna talks. In a post on Twitter, Ali Shampani said that Iran was evaluating the adoption of new negotiation initiatives to accelerate the achievement of the result. President Ibrahim Raisi also confirmed that Iran's negotiating team was seriously involved in the talks aimed at reviving the 2015 deal, the JCPOA. Raisi, however, noted that his government's actions weren't affected or delayed by the ongoing negotiations in the Austrian capital. The parties to the Vienna talks say they have made progress toward the restoration of the JCPOA, but Iran says its key demands, including a guarantee against U.S. violations, are the top priority. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken dismisses as irrelevant his Russian counterpart's demands on the 2015 Iran deal. Sergei Lavrov had called for the U.S. guarantees that sanctions imposed on Russia over Ukraine will not harm Moscow's cooperation with Tehran. In an interview with CBS News, Blinken said that the anti-Russia sanctions have nothing to do with the Iran deal known as the JCPOA. He stressed that Washington's 2018 pullout from the JCPOA was one of the worst mistakes by the U.S. Blinken said that returning to the agreement is profoundly in his country's interests. America's withdrawal reinstated sanctions on Iran and threw the JCPOA into disarray. To revive the accord, diplomatic efforts have been ongoing for nearly a year. Iran says that the U.S. should verify or remove the sanctions and give guarantees that it won't quit the deal again. Now, we've talked to our Vienna-based correspondent, Homa Lesgi, and she explains how closer cooperation between Iran and the IAEA will help advance the JCPOA talks.
The agreement or arrangement that's been agreed upon between Iran and the International Atomic Energy Agency, which is being seen, of course, as a positive move when also it comes to the JCPOA talks that we're discussing now. We are hearing that today more meetings are set to take place, although, of course, we know that the E3 negotiators have gone back to the capitals for a little break, but we had a tweet, the latest from the UK diplomat, where she said that our work is continuing from the capitals via phone calls. For instance, she referred to a phone call she had with the Iranian Deputy Foreign Minister for Economic Diplomacy, Dr. Safari, who's in Vienna, as well as, of course, discussions continuing between the E3, the EU coordinator, Enrico Mora, and the US as well. So, again, this agreement between Iran and the agency is seen as one of the issues that's going to help the JCPOA talks, because Iran had said that it wants the issue of its safeguards-related questions to be as soon as possible, basically, to be closed or permanently resolved, so that would not be used as leverage by any of the participants or any kind of pressure by any of the participants if and when the JCPOA is indeed implemented.
Daesh terrorists have conducted a suicide attack in northwestern Pakistani city of Peshawar. It happened on Friday. The attack was the deadliest to hit the country in 4 years. Pakistani officials say operations to hunt down the masterminds behind the bombing are in progress. We've discussed that issue with our guests in our news review program.
And welcome to this edition of the News Review. In this edition, Pakistani officials say they have identified the network that carried out a suicide bombing in the northwestern city of Peshawar on Friday. Operations to dismantle the network have already been kicked off. Special investigation teams of the counterterrorism department and Peshawar police are involved. So far, a number of suspects have been arrested. The blast hit a Shia mosque when people were holding Friday prayers. The death toll has now climbed to 63. Nearly 200 were wounded, too. The attack was the deadliest hit to hit Pakistan since 2018. The Daesh terror group has claimed responsibility. The bombing drew widespread international condemnation and raised calls for tackling terror groups operating in Pakistan. Now, to discuss that further, we are joined by our correspondent, Kamran Youssef, joining us live from Islamabad, and also Mr. Masoud Shajare, head of the Islamic Human Rights Commission, joining us from London. Now, let's begin with our very own correspondent there, Kamran Youssef. Can you give us more details about this network that has been discovered?
Well, the network has not been identified by the Pakistani authorities. They simply stated that the people and the group or the network that was behind the Friday's deadly attack has been identified. Certain suspects have also been taken into custody. The identity of the attacker or the suicide bomber has also been established. So they are saying that they are closing in on the network that was behind this incident. We have also seen that the country's Prime Minister Imran Khan stated the same, that they are close to finding out that who was behind this deadly attack, and soon those who were behind it will be brought to book and will be given them the exemplary punishment.
Thank you very much. And Mr. Masoud Shajare, we are dealing with organized crime here. Do you see it in the Pakistani government? Do you see the capability to deal with organized crime at this level?
Yes, I don't know to what extent we say organized crime in the sort of face of what organized crime is elsewhere. But definitely sectarianism has been used by India, by Saudi Arabia, and other world players, and United States and the West, to create these divisions. And these divisions are being created day in, day out. And as I explained, it goes deep to the heart of some of the madrasas and so forth, who this sectarianism is being drummed in to the mind of very young children all
exactly,
the way
until Mr. Shajara. I'm sorry that I'm stopping you right there. That's precisely what I mean by the Pakistani government having the capability of stopping this, because this needs educating the younger generation. It needs control over the education of the younger generation, basically. It's not just picking up a gun or trying to find a network of people who are carrying out attacks. It also requires education.
It requires education, but, you know, above everything else, we really need to remove these tools in the hand of those who want to conflict these divisions. And the way we do it is actually stop this tit for tat. This particular mosque and the alim there was committed to the unity of the Muslims. He spoke out against discrimination and sectarianism day in, day out. The fact of the matter is that these takfiris who commit these acts of horror, they target those who are for unity. So they're not targeting the sort of their counterpart who are sort of promoting divisions. They are targeting those who stand for unity. What we need to do and what the Pakistani government needs to do is to stop this sort of escalation of disunity from the young age in the different masajids and madrasas.
Thank you very much. That was Masood Shajara, head of the Islamic Human Rights Commission from London, and our very own Kamran Youssef, live from Islamabad. Thanks to both of you, gentlemen, for sharing your thoughts and the information that you have with us on this edition of the News Review.
That's a wrap for this News Bulletin. Goodbye.
This is IRIB English Radio. With you early in the morning. With you at midday. With you till the night's end. IRIB English Radio. From the very heart of evergreen forests, under the starry sky of the desert, with the radiance of silver-colored sand, in the midst of proud mountains, close up, Iran.
Hello, I am Mitra, an Iranian nature traveler. To know more about the wonders and beauties of magnificent Iran, keep me company. Where is the lentil? In the legumes cupboard. Yes. And this is the lentil. Just a cup. I pour some in this plate. And then some water on it. And now I have to cover the plate with a clean cloth. And this is the cloth. And now I put the plate in a dark, warm place so that the lentil could sprout. This is called sabz-sabz kardan in Farsi, which means growing a green in English. It's an ancient tradition which we observe near the Iranian New Year. We put sabz along with six other elements, starting with the letter S, on half zinc cloth, and welcome the New Year. Today we are going to take a tour to Tehran's streets in order to get more familiar with the spirit in the final days of the year in Iran. Nowruz is the first day of solar calendar year, the celebration of the Iranian New Year, and the most ancient festivities remained from ancient Iran. Nowruz is the celebration of the beginning of spring, which is called spring equinox. Iran is not the only country which celebrates Nowruz. Some other countries in the region also enjoy Nowruz and its festivities, including Afghanistan, Tajikistan, Georgia, Iraq, Turkey, Russia, India, Pakistan, and Uzbekistan. The United Nations Educational, Scientific, and Cultural Organization, UNESCO, listed Nowruz as a cultural and spiritual heritage for mankind, designating the day as the International Day of Nowruz. In Shahnameh of Ferdowsi, we read that Jam, one of the mythological kings of Iran, while passing through Azerbaijan, got seated on a throne and was crowned. By shining the sun on the crown, the world got illuminated. The people got happy and called the day Nowruz and called Jam, Jamshid. This myth is representation of the commemoration of the end of winter and cold and the beginning of warmth, light, and life by Iranians. I am now in Tajrish neighborhood. In Iran, the last month of the year, which is called Esfand, is a very busy month. People come to bazaars for shopping and getting ready for Nowruz. Tajrish has a traditional bazaar as well as some other bazaars which are really busy in the final days of the year. I am now near Tajrish Bazaar. Here, there are vendors who sell sabze and flowers on the street. Those who have not yet made their sabze can purchase these ready ones. And the special flower for Nowruz is hyacinth. This flower is the symbol of spring. I'll buy two for my grandma and myself. I am now at a herbs store in Tajrish Bazaar. I'm here to buy some sumac for my half-seen clod. Sumac is a mountain shrub which has clustered fruits. The fruits are used as spice after being dried and crushed. Sumac is the symbol of patience in Haftsin clad. I am now in a vegetable shop. What fresh, colorful vegetables are here? Oh, wow, the smell of basil is everywhere. I'm going to buy some garlic for my Haftsin clad. Garlic has medicinal advantages and is the symbol of being away from diseases in Haftsin clad. And let's go to this neat, beautiful fruit shop. Apple is one of the elements of Haftsin clad and is the symbol of health and vigorousness. Here, there are yellow and red apples both. Both of them are allowed at Haftsin clad, though I prefer red apples. Oh, these apples have beautiful red color. Oh, look at there. Samanu shop. Samanu is a type of food which is made by wheat sprout. This food is naturally sweet, without being added sugar. In the past, people used to cook samanu at home. You know, the process of cooking samanu takes a long time and needs much patience. So, in today's world, which everything has become so rapid, people usually buy samanu ready from stores instead of cooking it at home. However, the samanu, which is made at home, has a greater quality. Fortunately, my grandma still observes traditions and cooks her own samanu at home. She also leaves my share aside. Samanu is the symbol of blessing and abundance. Well, one object is left. Coin. Coin is the symbol of wealth and property. Now, my half scene is complete. I wish you all the best wherever you're listening to this program. Until next time, goodbye.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
Doing a song from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Russia's military operation against Ukraine continues unabated.
What is evidently clear is that Russia will not halt its offensive until its goals are met, like what it calls denazifying and the demilitarization of Ukraine. Meanwhile, the West is pumping Ukraine with more arms, promoting fighting the Russian military machine. In this edition of The Spotlight, we will look at why the West is doing that and whether that approach will cost Ukrainians their country while the death toll continues to mount. Let me introduce our guest for this edition of The Spotlight. Don DeBar is a writer, radio host, and journalist who joins us from New York. Also joining us, Ian Williams. He is the president of the Foreign Press Association, who also joins us from New York.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
I'd like to welcome you both from New York, and I'll start first with you, Don DeBar. So what is Russia calling this? A campaign that is a special military operation is the phrase they used. It has said it has no plans to occupy Ukraine, and the Russian president, Vladimir Putin, says he wants a demilitarized, denazified, and neutral Ukraine. What do you think? Do you believe him? Or what do you think his intentions are?
Well, self-explanatory. Certainly, Russia, the nation state in the world with the largest, by far, land mass, is not after a land grab. Certainly, the placement of U.S. Military forces along Russia's borders, the bellicose foreign policy towards Russia, for sure since 2015, 2016, when they were accused of meddling and stealing the election, and people like Jean Shaheen in the U.S. Senate were saying that their propaganda was an act of war with a body count, certainly have reason to be concerned with the abrogation of the the INF Treaty, Intermediate Range Missiles, and the Open Skies Treaty during the Trump administration, which was actually so benign compared to the previous administration that everyone was calling Trump Putin's puppet. They have some concerns about displacement of missiles that can make it to Moscow from Ukraine in 4 minutes and a policy of placement of troops, materiel, that are clearly intended not only for an invasion, but actually begin almost at the furthest into the Soviet Union that Hitler achieved in the 40s with his invasion.
Very well. Ian Williams, I saw you shaking your head, but I'm going to ask you your response to what Putin has said. Additionally to what I asked Don DeBar, he has said the move was undertaken, quote, to protect people who have been, quote, subjected to bullying and genocide, and that Russia will strive, and this is a quote, for the demilitarization and denazification of Ukraine. What is your view?
Every word is a lie, and some are too. Denazification. His own Wagner Brigade of mercenaries have card-carrying Nazis in there. Denazification with a Jewish president? I mean, this man is frothing at the mouth. Let's get the facts straight. He invaded another country without provocation. They didn't invade him. He invaded them. He did so in violation of the United Nations Charter, which forbids the acquisition of territory by force and forbids armed action. He went to the Security Council, was defeated in the Security Council, and used an historical relic of a veto to do it. He went to the United Nations General Assembly and was resoundingly condemned there. He has now, remember, we're talking about protecting Russians. Kharkiv is a city that's mostly Russian-speaking. That's the one you've seen with bombs flying in there. Russian bombs hitting the Russian
people. Why is he doing that then? Why do you think
this
he's doing that?
This is the epitome of destroying a village to protect it. This is about Putin's power. It's not about protecting.
Let's get a reaction from Don DeBar. Don DeBar, go ahead.
I don't want to waste time on hysterical laughter. And the president of Ukraine is actually a paid professional comedian for most of his career. And also, on occasion, he's funny. I'm looking at the news reports today where Blinken announced that the United States is going to authorize, quote-unquote, NATO countries to hand over, quote-unquote, jet fighters to Ukraine. In other words, in essence, the U.S. is going to start conducting an aerial war over Ukraine because these planes are going to be backfilled by the United States, according to Blinken today, and you can't fly those planes without U.S. AWACS helping them to target and to locate the enemy planes. And so what we're talking about, while people are making up fantasies about what's going on, an actual, moving up close to an engagement between U.S. and Russian forces in the air over Ukraine.
Ian Williams, now, let me jump in. Hold on to your thoughts there. Ian Williams, what he's saying, what our guest there is saying, basically U.S. is actively working on a plan to arm Ukraine more, and based on the most latest, as Don DeBar said, jets are going to come into. Why is the U.S. promoting this and other countries?
Pressure from the world.
Why
aren't they doing more? There are a lot of people who say they should actually threaten troops. Let's consider, since we're doing all this whataboutery, why is it that Russian armed forces are fighting in Syria to keep a barbaric, genocidal dictator in power at the invitation of the government? However, when it comes to Ukraine, the elected government asks for arms to defend itself against an actual full-scale military incursion by its neighbor.
Do you think Ukrainian army can withstand
nothing at all. Let's look at those conscripts they're sending in. The interviews of them are pathetic. These poor kids have been dragged. They've been shoved into the army. They've been pushed across a border with no information. They've been told they're going to liberate. What do they see when they get there? They see civilians standing in front of the tanks.
Okay.
They see people in the houses that are being shelled and bombed from high altitude. This is just...
All right, Ian Williams, hold on. Let's get down to
any civilized human being can condone what Putin is doing, which is why even China wouldn't back him, because they know he's pushed the envelope.
That's a good question. We're
going
to get to China. We're going to get to China a little later in the program. Don DeBar, go ahead.
First of all, I have to say that Biden reads his teleprompter better than he's reading the talking points here out of Langley. Almost every alleged statement of fact that you're making about conscripts, about all of this, complete fantasy. I'm talking to people that are on the ground there. They're telling me what they're seeing in front of them. They're telling me about Ukrainian soldiers putting their guns down and going to the camps of the Russians and having lunch with them. I'm hearing about and reading about also, even in Western press, about the Ukrainian army going in and taking out Azov battalion in Mariupol, because Azov battalion was preventing these civilians there from leaving the city on this guaranteed routes out that the Russians had provided. And so the actual Ukrainian
army...
The
one that they're shelling, that one, perhaps.
Okay, Ian Williams.
The guaranteed route out.
Let me ask you this, Ian Williams.
Yeah. It's well marked, the shell craters from the Russian army.
Ian Williams.
And you're evading the major point. The Russian army is in Ukraine. The Ukrainian army isn't in Russia. Who's invading whom? What special military operation is this? When the U.S. went into Vietnam, they talked about pacification. They talked about destroying villages to save them.
Ukraine is currently an American colony.
All right.
To save.
We got to have one at a time speaking.
If it's being shelled.
Very well. Ian Williams, let me ask you this question, because I want to ask the same thing from Don DeBar. When you take a look at the Ukrainian army versus the Russian military, who is going to overpower the other? I mean, we're seeing arms flow into Ukraine in huge amounts, but we know what Russia's military is capable of. Based on your expert analysis, how do you think one measures up to the other?
I am an ethical analyst, not a military analyst. I think the Ukrainian army has done extremely well under the circumstances, because this was supposed to be
but
a blitzkrieg.
But if you saw Death Toll Mount, would you not want to stop the war?
A blitzkrieg in which Russian armor would go in and take Kyiv. They have a column like a tapeworm
stretched
across Ukraine for
40
miles.
Okay,
because it's run out of fuel. It's run out of food. It's being harassed by the locals. Its military equipment is being towed away by peasants with tractors. It's pathetic.
Okay.
But they've got a lot of troops. They have a lot of hardware and military equipment. And, you know, the odds are on the Russians. But then they have to occupy a country where it is quite clear that they are detested and reviled.
Don DeBar. So let me ask Don DeBar.
Even the Russian speakers
what he thinks. Don DeBar. Sorry, Ian Williams. Don DeBar, when you take a look. Thank you, Ian Williams. Don DeBar, when you take a look at the Russian military versus the Ukrainian military, one analyst has said that Russia is using 5% of its capabilities. When you take a look at Russia's military in your perspective, if it is superior or has far more capabilities than the Ukrainian military, wouldn't logic dictate that the president of that country should stop the civilian death toll of mounting and therefore put a stop to this, which is what President Putin has said, regardless of whether Putin is right or wrong?
I mean, the short answer is yes. First of all, you have a few difficulties, however, because Zelensky has been in Warsaw since last weekend. He's not even in Ukraine. He fled first to Lviv, or Lviv, depending on your preference, with the NATO HQ in Ukraine and the U.S. ambassador to Ukraine a week ago. And I don't know if he was in a suitcase for protection with them or on a leash, like a monkey on a with an organ grinder. But they fled by Monday, I believe. They started having press conferences with NATO's people from Ukraine in Warsaw. This was, by the way, while last
they
weekend,
had one.
They were
so
talking
you're ignoring
about
all the pictures of him in the center there. You're all ignoring all the pictures. Compare Putin. He's at the end of a table. He's at the opposite side of a football stadium from his own cabinet.
Well, Ian Williams, let Don DeBar finish. Ian Williams, I'm sorry.
He's such a paranoid, crazy person.
Very
he
well.
Does not trust
Don DeBar, go
advice.
Ahead. Ian Williams, I'm sorry. I'm going to come to you in a second. Don DeBar, go ahead.
So I wanted to finish. So at last weekend when they were trying to negotiate for this past Monday's talks between Ukraine and Russia, Zelensky was insisting that they meet in Warsaw, despite the fact that Russia was saying, let's meet in Ukraine near the Belarus border. And the reason they didn't want to was because he was already in Warsaw. He fled the country. While he has people conscripting 16-year-old boys, okay, he's in Warsaw with NATO
as
HQ
tell,
and the U.S.
He's in Ukraine, and why would you
Ukraine
go to close to the Russian border when you've got a bunch of murderous psychopaths, including a president who kills his own opponents with poison darts, who poisons people on his own territory, who goes into Britain to poison,
first
and
of all,
he's supposed to get
well,
close to this?
Let's talk about the U.K.
I mean,
okay, the empire that never set the subject set
you're
on
evil
with the millions of bodies.
All right, if you both speak at the same time, we're not going to understand what you're saying, and I'm the third person. So let's stop that. Let's look at the assertive Putin that Ian Williams is against, obviously, what he's doing. Don DeBar, I need to bring this side of Putin in the picture, but then get your analysis. So Ian Williams, Ukraine could cease to exist. That is what the Russian President Vladimir Putin has said in a warning. If leaders continue to do what they are doing, saying that countries imposing a no-fly zone will be considered combatants. So Putin is issuing
so
his
saying,
warnings. Why is he talking
saying,
in that level?
Remember, he has threatened the use of nuclear weapons. He is now a self-confessed war criminal.
My
he
question is,
the nuclear option.
Why is he
not
so assertive? Why is he portraying
not even Kim Jong-un has threatened the nuclear option. Putin has. That means
why? Why
he
has he done that? Why has he done
but
that?
More to the point is, he is saying, I am going to wipe out a sovereign country.
But why? Why would he say that?
In defiance of the UN treaty, in defiance of its own people, regardless.
Okay.
So when you look at Zelensky, is he Churchill or is he Stalin?
Okay.
Stalin could have
Thank
surrendered
you.
In 1941 and saved lots of Russian lives. But he said not one step backwards.
All right. Thank Churchill. You, Ian Williams. Let me get Don DeBar in. Let me get Don DeBar in, Ian Williams. Please.
These people are remembered
Thank you.
With some reference and reverence because they stood up against evil aggressors. Putin is an evil aggressor. Zelensky is standing up against them.
Thank you.
Amazingly so, by the way.
All right, Ian Williams. Don DeBar, same question to you. Why is Putin coming out off so assertive and so extreme, in a sense, in terms of the warnings that he's issuing against Ukraine?
He said so himself. There's a knife at our throat. That's what he was talking about for Russia. The United States has been moving NATO forces, military forces, to Russia's border on a steady march since 1989, really, when Germany was reunified, despite promises and assurances. Forget all that. Grown-ups don't believe what each other say, even with contracts. That's why they have courts and appellate courts and such. And that's why there are wars, too, by the way, because people breach agreements. But the United States has moved its military up to Russia's borders and been pounding on its chest and training the people of the United States to tolerate a war, in essence, and lying about how much they'll tolerate, like Reuters just did. Reuters said in a report on Friday that a poll that they had conducted this past week showed that 74% of Americans would tolerate or accept the need for no-fly zone over Ukraine. That if you actually go dig, because they had no links to any of the stories either on their own website or what was sent out, but go into their own polling company's website and find the questionnaire, that question was never on there. Uh-huh. And the only two closely related ones were 2-1 against. No troops to go there and no aerial bombing of Ukraine on behalf of Ukraine's government.
Okay.
So he knows what's going on.
Robert Terry polls 90%.
So let's get down to
support their president.
In Williams,
much lower. Putin has achieved Finland in NATO, Sweden in NATO. He'll probably get Switzerland in NATO.
I read that in the paper
today. It's cheap. An increase in military spending in all the countries of NATO, including Germany, which was thoroughly agnostic about this before. He has scored a spectacular geopolitical own goal.
Very well. Okay. Let me move on to this issue. This is a topic that we don't talk about.
Ian Williams. By the time he's finished selling reactors and dropping bombs on them.
Ian Williams.
But he will have lost.
This is a topic that's not talked about much. From what Putin has said, people may be dismissing it. But Putin has said about these nationalists, and I need for you to give us what your impression or understanding of it is. He says nationalists are using civilians as human shields. He said that at a press conference. He said this to the Turkish president also, in the context where he said actions of the nationalists, which he called the neo-Nazi units, look particularly cruel and cynical. They continue intensive shelling of Donbas and use civilians, including foreigners, who are basically taken hostage as human shields in Ukrainian cities and towns. Do you believe him? Is that what's happening?
No.
Okay.
I think he's
Don
lying.
DeBar, what do you think?
It's obvious that that's what's happening. That's what's happening right now in Mariupol. The Ukrainian army thinks that that's what's happening, and that's why they killed 20 Azov members in their headquarters.
Ian Williams, you heard our guest.
I haven't heard that report, but if it's true, it contradicts what he's saying. It means the Ukrainian government is taking action against
Azov,
a militant militia there.
True.
So they are taking action against the people perpetrating these crimes. On the other hand, it is definitely true that there's a couple of 100,000 Russian troops inside Ukraine, unwanted by the people, shooting at civilians. Civilians who are demonstrating on the streets against them, who are standing in front of tanks and military equipment
rolling. You've said that.
Who do you see on this? You can see it plainly. This is an armed aggression against the people who are now united.
You've made that stance very clear.
Ukraine will
Don
never
DeBar,
ever unite with
thank
Russia.
You.
I thought Ukraine and Russia shouldn't have split myself, but they did, and they did so partly because of Russian arrogance and Yeltsin and American support on it. However, they have now split, and it's no more. It's less likely that Ireland will reunite with England than that Ukraine will reunite with Russia.
Let's move on. We just have a few minutes left. I'm sorry. Don DeBar, plain and simple here, a question that I want to ask you. What is the role of the U.S. here? What is it doing? We know it's providing arms and encouraging other nations to do that, but what is it instructing Ukraine to do here?
First, let's start with a telephone call made on February 4th, 2014, between Jeff Pyatt, who was the U.S. ambassador to Ukraine's elected government at that time, and Victoria Nuland, who was the Undersecretary of U.S. Undersecretary of State for European Affairs, where they selected the people who were going to become the government on February 25th, 2014. Those people, in turn, set up an election for Poroshenko to become president, who was really the guy behind their grouping. This is after $5 billion of U.S. money was spent setting up the preconditions for this to happen. That government has been a satrap, a colony of the United States, since it was placed in power in February of 2014. And the first thing that that government did when it took power was declare war on the eastern part of the country and begin shelling it.
The one that was occupied by the Russian troops. I remember it well.
The body count is 14,000 Ukrainians thus far, 80% of them in the east.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Ian Williams, same question to you, but the blame I'm going to talk about here and ask you is that Russia wants to replace the current government, and it's after what some have called regime change. At the same time, there are news that's seeping out. It's not verified, but it's indicating that the U.S. is also looking at the next government that should be there in Ukraine, in a sense, drawing the conclusion that it wants to beat Russia to the punch, I guess. What do you think is happening here?
The indications are, as I remember, that American officials said that the president of Ukraine and his government have set in place succession plans for if they are killed by the invading Russians. Now, that is a complete reversal of what you're talking about.
Sure.
They're setting up succession plans, just like the president and the vice president and all the rest of it. They will still have a functioning government so that Putin can't foist in his own government to negotiate with. The one thing, I repeat, once again, it's clear, and even the Russians aren't claiming it, is that Russia has very little constituency in Ukraine, that they will never get popular support, that they will have to forcibly impose an occupation, a quisling government, if they come in, that that government will then have no credibility at all. So it really is a busted flush. And everything else, it really is sort of nostalgia for the good old days of the Comintern and the Soviet Union, who we will always support because they're on the far side of progress. The U.S. is
okay.
Busted flush in many ways.
I got one
but
final question.
It's right. And I come from Britain, where the Americans were evil, double-dealing, but they did come to our aid in 1941.
Very well. Last question
Elated.
Here. I have
and
to
I'm
ask Don DeBar. I'm sorry. Putin has revealed the conditions for a ceasefire, Don DeBar, but it's nothing new. Kiev must cease fighting and fulfill Moscow's demands in order for this Russian military operation to stop against Ukraine. Of course, we know what those promises are. And Russia is not coming short on that. So what are we looking at here? Is that going to happen? Or are we still looking at Russia continuing its offensive until it obtains its goals?
Well, first, coming back to earth to describe the situation on the ground in Ukraine, the eastern half of the country not only welcomed the Russian military in, but in fact, they've been crying for them for the last 8 years. One of the pressures on Putin, in fact, was the fact that the Duma, 2 weeks prior to the beginning of this operation,
was that the Duma he appointed, where if anyone speaks against, they get waltzed up by the police?
They're elected,
yeah, sure.
Just like the parliament in Britain. Let me finish my statement, please.
Go ahead, Condemar.
Almost unanimously called on him to recognize those two republics. The reason are that they're people that have families in both places, and there's domestic political pressure across Russia for him to protect those people,
okay.
And it was demanded by the people that live there.
I'm sorry.
When the troops arrived in the eastern part of the
Don
country,
DeBar, I'm really sorry. I have to jump in. Unfortunately, we're just fresh out of time. I do apologize. Thank you for both of you, Don DeBar. Thank you, writer, radio host, and journalist from New York, and also from New York, Ian Williams. Thank you for your input, writer, radio host. I'm sorry, president of the Foreign Press Association USA. And with that, we come to an end for this edition of the Spotlight. From Mikhail Tarvey and the team, it's goodbye until next time.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
I- IRIB English Radio presents
Viewpoints.
Viewpoints.
With the presence of different scholars.
With the presence of different scholars. IRIB English Radio.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio This is your host Musa Al-Bahadali and you are now listening to the program Viewpoints Joining us in the studio today is their friend Sheikh Muhammad Khani from the Islamic Seminary of Qum and Dr. Ali Alawiyan I welcome you both to this program and I hope that we will have a fruitful discussion today بإذن الله تعالى
Thank you very much.
Our topic today, dear friends, is about drugs, more specifically drug addiction. Yeah. Dear Sheikh, do we have any treatments mentioned in Islam, how we can treat such a problem?
Yeah, that's a good question. Like, I know there's a association right now that are dealing with these issues and finding solutions that they can actually implement in the different rehab centers around Iran. But if we have to look at what is drug addiction is basically a habit. It's an addiction, right? So it's something that you're used to because of the pleasure that are behind it. So normally when they discuss this in ethics, when it comes to habits, how to deal with habits, especially if it's a bad habit, normally they say that you have to replace that habit, especially if it's accompanied by some sort of a pleasure.
Right.
Because a person is normally not ready to sacrifice the pleasure, if not, it's replaced with something, right?
True. Yeah.
So, if a person understands, or he felt or experienced the pleasure of being a healthy person, normally he's not willing to sacrifice this pleasure for a pleasure that is lower than that. For example, eating unhealthy. There's some pleasure related to that as well. Yeah. But if you're a healthy person and you experience what it means to be healthy, you're normally not willing to eat unhealthy and experience that pleasure because you're going to sacrifice another and greater pleasure because of that.
So we should introduce something that is, I don't want to say as addictive, but as pleasurable as drugs.
We should find a solution and give him the tools to actually strengthen his own willpower. That's first and foremost, yeah? Because they have to come from outside. You cannot control people's addictions. Right. You cannot be like, you shouldn't do it if he wants to do it. Sooner or later, if he's under control, if he's in a controlled environment, sooner or later he's going to do it. You can control it for a period, for example. That's why we say, like, when we have to raise our children, we do exactly the same thing. We give them the willpower enough or strengthen their willpower enough so they can take the right decisions when they grow older.
So we should focus on a cure is what we are in agreement then. Mm. One such cure or a manner of controlling these drug addicts, especially in the US, and it has now spread in the world, is to legalize some drugs, some less harmful drugs such as marijuana. Do you, dear Sheikh, think that this is an effective method?
That's a very good discussion because I actually looked into it and apparently there's a huge discussion when it comes to fiqh about whether marijuana is legal or not, whether it's been considered as being muskir or not. And goes under that definition. There's a huge discussion. Normally, our scholars, respected scholars today, they consider it to be impermissible because of the side effects of it, the harm it causes on a society for a human being, and so on and so forth.
Harm? Which harm, if I might ask?
Yeah, like for example, if a person is addicted to it, there's a lot of other aspects of his life which he normally doesn't take care of. Like for example, his family. Right. Normally there's abuse related to, like, for example, smoking a lot or excessive use of these things, of these drugs. The harm in the society is, for example, criminality is often related to selling
drugs.
That's
why we legalize it.
Yeah, but that's the question. If you legalize it, what you're actually doing, you're pushing the borders further, right?
Right.
So now they can't make money on marijuana and drugs like marijuana, light drugs, as we define them as. But there's always like heroin, cocaine, and so they can always change it with something else, right? We're just pushing the borders for what's being normalized in a society. So I don't think it's the right way to actually go. Yeah, because the criminality or the criminal activity, they're not gonna, just going to stop and be like, okay, now right. We don't have any way to make money. They're going to find something else. Right?
In this way, I think we need to go again to legislate what cigarette is, but the legislation of cigarette, we have to review. And we have seen even in recent scholars and religious authorities like Ayatollah Makarem, Hafizahullah, he also actually... no cigarette as something haram for a person to use it.
But when do that, dear doctor, you subconsciously you have to set some rules, because if we say cigarettes are harmful, what about using cola, drinking cola, which is very harmful?
As I said earlier, we have a general rule that لا تلقوا بأيديكم ولا